evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, October 13, 2014. The UN Special Envoy on Sexual Violence says the worst cases of sexual abuse she has ever heard about have occurred in South Sudan.
It's unbelievable. It's painful. It's very challenging to be able to see the conditions under which women live and the circumstances under which they have to live on a day-to-day basis.
And members of the SPLM meet with breakaway factions in the Tanzanian town of Arusha.
We would want to remain one if the other two parties are willing to recognize the choice of the people of South Sudan in voting for freedom from Khartoum and in the elected government.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Delegates from the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement, or SPLM, are meeting today in the Tanzanian city of Arusha with members of breakaway factions of the party. An SPLM official tells Waki Simon Wudu that the aim of the meeting is to overcome differences that led to splits in the SPLM and try to unite the party.
An Ito, the acting secretary general of the SPLM, told a news conference in Juba that delegations of the ruling SPLM, which is loyal to President Salva Kiir, of former Vice President Riek Machar's SPLM in opposition, and of the Group of 11, or G11, led by former SPLM Secretary General Pagan Amum, have all traveled to Arusha for the meeting. The G11 is made up of former ruling party members who were detained when fighting erupted in Juba in December last year. Some of them, including Amum, were held for several months accused of plotting to overthrow the government. The meeting is expected to last 3 days. It was put together by Tanzania's ruling party, the Chama cha Mapinduzi, or CCM. Ito says delegates from the three factions will
share experiences of other movements who have gone through similar conflicts, but also other movements who have become ruling parties in governments, and see how best, through these lessons learned, the leaders of SPLM can narrow down their differences and come up with a way forward that would unify the ranks and files of the SPLM leaders.
South Sudan's ruling party is trying hard to restore peace and stability in South Sudan, she says. And the talks in Arusha are expected to work in tandem with the peace negotiations led by Regional Bloc, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, that have been underway in Ethiopia since January.
This, we think, is very, very important because it will directly and indirectly support the efforts of IGAD. And in fact, on our part, our delegation was sent with a very clear message that we would want to remain one if the other two parties are willing to recognize the choice of the people of South Sudan in voting for freedom from Khartoum and in the elected government.
Daniel Awet, a member of the SPLM Political Bureau, is leading the SPLM team at the Arusha talks, Ito says. Taban Dengai, a chief negotiator for the SPLM in opposition at peace talks in Ethiopia, is leading the opposition faction, and Amum leading the delegation of the G11, Ito says. Meanwhile, Ito says a separate high-level team from the ruling SPLM is on its way to China for talks with that country's ruling party. Ito says the SPLM delegates expect during their visit
to learn how the Communist Party of China managed to move China, the whole of China, from poverty to where it is. That is learning from experiences. We want to know how and when to change your policies if they are not working. We need our cadres to have the capacity to understand how to formulate the correct policies. We also need our cadres to understand what discipline is, discipline within the party. We also want our cadres to know how to mobilize people, how to engage people, how to convince people about taking responsibility of this nation.
The SPLM grew out of the military movement that fought for decades for South Sudan's independence from Khartoum. After the death of its founder, John Garang, in 2005, the SPLM split into several factions and several more groups have broken away from the party since the latest conflict began last year. Some of the breakaway groups, including Machar's SPLM in opposition, have accused President Kiir and his administration of having dictatorial tendencies and governing in an undemocratic way. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu from Juba.
The UN Secretary General's Special Envoy on Sexual Violence in Conflict, who toured South Sudan for past week, says she heard the worst reports of sexual violence in her life from women in South Sudan. Zainab Bangura is calling on the leaders of the warring parties to stop using sexual violence as a tool of war.
UN Special Envoy Zainab Bangura says from the reports she has received, it is clear that both government and rebel forces have sexually abused women.
It's unbelievable. It's painful. It's very challenging to be able to see the conditions under which women live and the circumstances under which they have to live on a day-to-day basis. The harassments and sexual violence that takes place at checkpoints, and when the women go out to get food and when they go to get firewood, it's really, really extremely distressing.
Last week, Bangura met with the displaced women living in a UN camp in Bentiu, one of the areas hardest hit by the 10-month-long conflict. She says the crimes committed against the women in the Unity State Capital are unspeakable.
These are not conditions and circumstances under which women can live. I had a story of a woman who had just given birth who was raped. I had a story of an old woman who was raped. I had stories of children as young as 10, 11 years old who are being raped on a daily basis.
Bangura was fighting back tears as she described the extent of sexual violence South Sudanese women have had to endure.
I have traveled around the world, and I come from a conflict country, but I have never seen what I saw today. I came from Sierra Leone. I had the war. I was in the capital city when the capital city fell. We picked bodies in the streets and buried them. I worked for Liberia in Liberia for 2 years. I traveled all the counties. I've gone to Somalia and I've gone to DRC. I've gone to Central African Republic. But in all my life, I've gone to Bosnia. In all my life and experience of nearly 30 years in public service, and in the UN and as a government minister, I've never seen what I've saw today.
Bangura says the women she met in South Sudan told her they have suffered for too long and want the country's leaders to restore peace in the country.
They share their experience with me and what they have to go through on a daily basis, on a regular basis, the challenges, the risk. But then they gave me a message. They said, we want to give you one message to the president of South Sudan and to the opposition leader. Enough is enough. We want peace. They must sign that peace agreement and they have to keep to it because we want to go back home.
During her week-long visit, Bangura met with the top officials, including President Salva Kiir. She told him his administration must stop the sexual violence and bring the perpetrators to justice. Bangura also called on government and health agencies to ensure that victims of sexual violence be treated immediately, receive counseling. She says South Sudanese women, like women everywhere around the world, deserve to be treated with respect and dignity. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu reporting from Juba.
South Sudanese traditional chiefs were in Rwanda to learn how to restore unity in communities and promote reconciliation after tragedy and violence. From Kigali, Mungume Debs Rakarinj files this report.
We are here at Kigali Genocide Memorial Center. At the memorial here, we have some of the program.
A guide is explaining to four traditional chiefs from Jonglei, Unity, Upper Nile, and Central Equatoria states how the 1994 genocide started in Rwanda and how Rwandans used a community-based program to heal the wounds left by the OJ of violence.
Be able to collect the mistake done in the past.
One of the South Sudanese community leaders, Alphonse Legela Kutombe from Central Equatoria, says he was surprised to learn about the Gachacha system of community-based courts that Rwandans used to put their tragedy behind them. He says he will take the lessons he learned in Rwanda back to South Sudan when he returns next week.
Since we came on the 9th, up to now, I have learned so many things. Among them, homegrown approach. To teach us that people among themselves sat down and reform what had been done.
Rwanda used Gacaca courts to bring suspects in the 1994 genocide to justice when it realized that the national court system was unable to handle all the cases before it. Under the Gacaca system, communities at the local level elected judges to hear the trials of genocide suspects accused of everything except planning the genocide. The courts were more lenient in sentencing if a person was repentant and sought to reconcile with the community. When the 12,000 Gacaca courts closed in May 2012, they had tried more than 1.2 million cases throughout the country. They also helped promote reconciliation by allowing genocide survivors to learn the truth about the death of their loved ones. Tombe says he thinks South Sudanese could learn from the Rwandan experience.
Imagine, Rwanda were misled, and when they recognized themselves that it was wrong, they came to understand. Why don't we understand like these people?
Chief Peter Mading Thiak from Jonglei State agrees. He says,
what I have learned here is that the genocide claimed many innocent lives, but I've also learned about dialogue, that when the community sat down and discussed among themselves, they were able to have peace. We can do this in South Sudan.
Habyarimana Jean Baptiste, Executive Secretary of the Rwanda's National Unity and Reconciliation Commission, says he also believes South Sudan can learn from Rwanda's tragic experience and how it came back from the dark days of 1994. He says South Sudanese could adapt to Rwanda's Gacaca system to suit their own needs. He says they should do so now rather than later.
We have been using them in solving the tragedy of Rwanda we have gone through, the genocide against Tutsi. So if we can use them and rebuild peace, rebuild unity, rebuild development, why not for them to use them before they had such tragedy?
South Sudan should focus on programs that encourage reconciliation, Jean-Baptiste says. He says forgiveness is a key first step on the road to reconciliation. Augustino Kol Deng is the head of the group that organized the South Sudanese traditional leaders' feast. He says if the chiefs take a message of reconciliation back to South Sudan, they are likely to be heard loud and clear.
Chiefs are the grassroots leaders who are close to the population in South Sudan. They would be the good ambassadors of peace and reconciliation within the communities in South Sudan.
More than 800,000 people died in Rwanda's 100-day genocide in 1994, which pitted the Hutu majority against the Tutsi minority. The country has come back from 1994 to be one of the shining stars of development in Africa. South Sudan's conflict began last December as a political row between backers of President Salva Kiir on one side and supporters of his former vice president, Riek Machar, on the other. Although South Sudanese have played down the ethnic overtones of the violence in their country, former Nigerian president Olusegun Obasanjo said last month that African Union Commission of Inquiry for South Sudan that he heads has found that the conflict in South Sudan quickly turned tribal, pitting Dinka against Nuer. For VOA News, I am Gumedev Siruakarinj in Kigali, Rwanda.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the mayor of Bor Town issues a ban on locally brewed alcohol and shisha. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you feel you have to pay bribes to get things done?
Yes, sometimes there are problems that come up that I need to pay bribe. Like when the police get you along the road, they tell you they will take you to court. Such a long process. The best thing to do is just to give it to them and then be on your way.
It's my right to get the services since I pay tax, so they are my rights. So I don't need to pay bribe to get my rights. Instead, I'll push for it. If I can request, if requesting does not help, I can as well push for it.
I don't think I have to pay any bribe. The only thing is that the condition at times, since you want a favor from somebody and for the person to grant you the favor is expecting something from you, you have to give him the bribe in order for the thing to be fast.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The mayor of the Jonglei state capital, Bor, has banned the sale of or consumption of locally brewed alcohol. The order was originally announced last November, 1 month before the violence broke out across the country, and therefore was rarely enforced. Officials now say the highly intoxicating drinks contribute to shooting and gender-based violence. Jacob Achek has more for VOA from Juba.
The ban also forbids smoking chicha, which is smoking tobacco through a water pipe. Last November, Mayor Nyal Majang Nyal ordered the city's popular chicha kept be shut down, calling the customers a hellish hazard. Nyal said now that the town is relatively secure. He went to enforce the order which banned chicha and all local brewed alcohol.
The type of the alcohol that are banned in Bor include the local brews and then illicit spirits, B-52, Knockout, Best, and the like. Those are the ones that are banned because they are so detrimental for human health and they are causing a lot of problems for the people in town.
Most of these highly intoxicating drinks, some of which are packed in sachet, are cheap. They are in cost from 4 to 10 South Sudanese pounds. Nyal said people from other farms who have no access to alcohol come to Bor town to drink and get drunk.
So we are telling the women to find alternatives for their business and desist from this business because it is not constructive to the society. It is actually killing the people.
Nyal said he will work with law enforcement agencies, including individual police officers, to enforce the order.
The order explains exactly what are the consequences of being found if you are on the other side of the law. So there are first-time offenders, second-time offenders, and third-time offenders. When you are caught for the third time of breaking this law or this order, you will be liable for charges, and you can even be imprisoned for it. So the order specifies how you will be punished.
John Nel Ayuen, who resides in Panliad village near Bo town, said municipality decision to ban alcohol will negatively impact people who earn a living from selling alcohol.
Do not close this alcohol. Everybody who rejected it is okay. Nobody can force him. Everybody with his own business, you know. Since 1983, we used to drink this and we are now taking our country out. So this one is like the planning of the family.
Abraham Mayol Nyal, who owns a bar in Bor, welcomed the ban on local brewed alcohol. He said enforcing the order will decrease drunkenness in the town.
The main decision of the state government on banning some of the alcohol is actually, to me, it is okay. It's fine. It is a good decision because of especially this small whiskey called Casta Blanca. It is very cheap and can easily be afforded by everyone, even children. And the second reason is it is also strong and easily destabilizes the mind of the consumer. So finally, it is widely welcomed by many people because of the crimes that are committed due to drunkenness.
Officials said a store found to be selling in light alcohol will have the item confiscated and destroyed immediately. For BOA News, I'm Jacob Achek in Juba.
From Bor, we now move to Bentiu. Each morning, the first thing residents of a protection site at the UN base in Unity State Capital do when they wake up is to grab a bucket and bowls to bail out water from their submerged homes. But it's not really accurate to call it water. It's more of a greenish-brown sludge mixed with garbage and human waste that has flooded the camp, housing 47,000 displaced people. VOA's Gabe Joslo has more from Bentiu.
For the displaced people here at the UN camp in Bentiu, every day is a fight against the rising water that has flooded homes, ruined schools, and cut off access to health facilities. People everywhere are soaked, walking through water sometimes as high as their waists to fetch firewood or visit the surprisingly vibrant market. Few people have boots, and children splash barefoot through the polluted muck. Outside one flooded home behind a stretch of shops, Mitarisa, a mother of eight, is helping her children to fix a mud wall around their submerged home. Inside, the floor is made of thick, sticky mud. At night, they share two beds, the only dry space in sight. We are struggling, she says. Sometimes we go without anything to eat. The place is filled with water, and the children cry from standing up all day with no place to sit down. Life was hard enough before the rains, which started around July and picked up during the last couple of weeks. The people living here escaped from fighting in Bentiu, the capital of oil-rich Unity State and the most contested area in the 10-month conflict between government forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and the armed opposition under the leadership of his former deputy, Riek Machar. Most of those displaced are from Machar's Nuer tribe, while the government soldiers who have retaken control of the town are mostly Dinka, the same as President Kiir. Ioannis Bith came to the Bentiu UN base in mid-April, when escalating fighting in the town brought a surge of people seeking the protection of peacekeepers stationed there. He says people would rather brave the waters in the camps than risk going back outside of them.
You don't go outside because there's a security problem from those of government troops. They get one of the people from the camps just only to kill. There's no more Islamic, and that's why people are like, this is staying here.
International aid organizations working at the protection site have had to switch priorities from providing basic services to draining the water. Gas-powered pumps run throughout the day to move water into the marshland outside the camps, while excavators build mud walls to keep water from rushing back in. Anga Razafi is the head of the Unity State Field Office for the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF.
All of the agencies together are trying to dig a big drainage to drain the water out. This is not enough. We're also pumping. That's the sound you hear right now. But still, there's too much water in this swampy area that it will take weeks to get all this water out.
Agencies are hoping to get bigger water pumps soon, but getting supplies into Bentiu is difficult as the rainy season has made roads impassable and everything must be flown in by helicopter. While the rains have presented one problem, there are concerns that the coming dry season could bring more fighting, putting further pressure on a population that has already had enough. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Bentiu, South Sudan.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. Turkey says it has not agreed with the U.S. to let American forces use a base in the country to launch operations against the so-called Islamic State militants in Syria and Iraq. U.S. Defense Chief Chuck Hagel announced the deal today for the use of the U.S. base at Incirlik, about 100 kilometers from Turkey's border with Syria, as a staging ground for airstrikes. Most health workers in Liberia reported to work today, ignoring calls for a strike that could have weakened efforts to fight the Ebola epidemic. The country's health workers association had told members to stay home unless they received higher hazard pay promised by the Liberian government. And finally, South African runner Oscar Pistorius is back in a Pretoria courtroom for a hearing to determine his sentence for killing his girlfriend. She was Reva Steenkamp, and she died last year. That's a look at today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
Prominent Kenyan-born scholar Professor Ali Mazrui died today at the age of 81. His family members say he had been unwell for some time. Mazrui lectured at several universities around the world and wrote 30 books during his lifetime. David Wachanga, a professor of journalism at the University of Wisconsin, Whitewater, says Mazrui tried through his work to bring African issues under this global spotlight.
I would argue that Ali Mazrui is the most prominent, or one of the most prominent, scholar from East Africa of his generation, not just because of number of work that he published, but because of the diversity of ideas that he generated. The other importance of Ali Mazrui's contribution to scholarship is that when he came back from Oxford in 1963, that was a period when the line between politician and academician or intellectual was not clear. We would find a lot of debates between Ali Mazrui and Julius Nyerere and Milton Obote. So what Ali Mazrui did is that he became a model of intellectuals do, that intellectuals should be influential in shaping national and public debate.
You worked with him for a number of years on a documentary. What are some of his philosophy in life?
His philosophy included considerable acceptance of multiculturalism, toleration of differences and dissent, and a considerable acceptance of diversity. He considered himself an African who was born in Mombasa, who was educated in the West, and he was called to prayer in Arabic. So the convergence of these three cultures, African, Islam, and Western, what he later called a triple heritage, has always been the defining model of his intellectual outlook.
And what legacy are we getting from this man who has written so many intellectual pieces on Africa and the heritage? What legacy is he leaving behind?
His core legacy is that Professor Mazrui was an active participant in producing and enriching a form of scholarship that provides a global view of Africa, especially because when he started writing, most African intellectuals were interested in the question of the national state. But Mazrui went a step further, and he opened African debate and located them in global debate. So apart from his major contribution to scholarship, Ali Mazrui has been able to connect that scholarship to other places. For example, the question of Islam in African society. And the fact that he was also educated in the West, he understood Europe very well. So he acted as a bridge builder because he could articulate African issues or issues rooted in Africanity in a language that was comprehensible to the West.
And you were too close to him, you know, during his last days. Are there any words of wisdom that he left with you?
The ability to listen, and the ability to hear. There was always a twinkle in Ali Mazrui's eye. He was able to understand and to hear what the person in front of him was saying. And because of his gift for language, he was able to articulate what had been said in a more persuasive and convincing way. In essence, he used to be respectful to the person who was in front of him. And I think that is one of the reasons that he was such a prolific scholar, because he respected ideas. He respected the people behind those ideas.
That's David Wachanga, professor of journalism at the University of Wisconsin, Whitewater. He was speaking to me from his home in the Wisconsin state capital, Madison, earlier today. That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Kuliyom Dushman by Emmanuel Kembe. We have been listening to Emmanuel Kembe with his song Kuliyom Dushman. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.